Support for MPB comes from the Mississippi Museum of Art in Jackson. What Became of Dr. Smith by artist Noah Satterstrom is on view beginning April 20th. Learn more at msmuseumart.org.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
Welcome to the Mississippi Arts Hour. I'm Malcolm White, your host today on the Arts Hour. I'm also the executive director for your Mississippi Arts Commission. In this special broadcast today, we listen again to my 2012 interview with Jim Dollarhide, the legendary Mississippi filmmaker who died in a house fire in March of 2016. In the first part of the conversation, I asked Jim about how his career started.
Well, it started in a dark room. To be specific, it's my dad was an amateur photographer. And in junior high school, he gently enlisted me to be his darkroom assistant. And, of course, back then, ages before digital, there was an enlarger.
Right.
And you projected your negative down on an easel, which had silver-based photographic paper. And then you put you had the kind of the red lamp on,
right.
And you put the paper in developer, and you saw the image come alive. It developed before your eyes.
The magic.
And, I mean, I have a collective memory of many images working in my dad's darkroom. But when I saw that first image, I was hooked. There was something about seeing that image come alive. Then later, I mean, within a year or two, I had a paper out and I worked a weekend job. And within a year or two, I had bought a Nikon camera.
Well, you started with the best.
So the images started becoming my images. And to see an image through the camera and then go into a photographic darkroom and see that image come alive was just mesmerizing to me. And I knew when I was 15 years old what I was going to do with my life.
Wow. I didn't.
Now, there's been a few curves here and there, twists in the road. But
right. Now, you grew up in Jackson?
Born in Greenwood.
Greenwood.
My family moved to Jackson when I was two. So I grew up in the Broadmoor section of North Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
My dad was a school band man at Bailey Junior High and then later at Murrah. And then later, in his retiring years, he was the manager of the Jackson Symphony.
But this photography was his hobby?
He was an amateur photographer. Actually, somebody on Facebook recently told me that my dad was one of the founders of the Jackson Photography Club back in the early 50s. And that's something about my dad I didn't know.
Cool.
While my father had many gifts, creative photography was not one of them.
Gotcha.
He mainly took snapshots of the family, and I have Kodachrome and Ektachrome 35mm transparencies of our family going back before I was born. And then black and white negatives that I've located, and I'm in the process of scanning of my family going back to, when my mom and dad got married.
So he was a band director and also later associated with the symphony. Was he also a musician?
Every great band man is a musician.
Right.
And you're not a great band man unless you can play all the instruments in the orchestra.
And so he played them all.
Yeah.
And you ever dabble in music?
Well, and, I was browbeat into it,
like being the photographer's assistant.
Right. Exactly. There was no question about it, whether or not I was going to be in the school band.
Right.
And in the 10th grade at Murrah, the yearbook editor, sponsor, was a lovely lady who is still around, I think, B. Donnelly. And she came in the band room one day and said, Roger, I need to make an announcement.
And Roger being your father?
Right.
Okay.
And she said, our school photographer has moved to Alabama, and we need a school photographer. Now, imagine me at this point. I've already been through 3 years of junior high band, and I was not a very good baritone horn player. The genes skipped me. So I'm under my dad's thumb. So I went, I looked at my dad, and he kind of cut his eyes at me like, okay, and I became the school photographer.
That was the segue.
Yep, that was it.
From performance.
I put down the baritone horn and picked up a Nikon.
So then you went off to college. Where did you attend college?
Well, actually, you know, I dropped out of high school in 1970 in the middle of the desegregation split.
Right.
Not because I had any racist views or anything, but nor did my family. But because the teachers at Murrah let me skip class, and I had not studied. I was not a good student, and I never went to class. I was always photographing something.
You were busy with your photography duties.
Fact was, I had a master key to the building, and I would go in the principal's office and get the class dismissal slips. And the principal, a guy named James Merritt, had a rubber stamp in his desk with his name on it. I would take a whole pad of class dismissal slips and stamp the whole pad. And I'd show up at my first class and turn in a class dismissal slip. Then I would go down to a standard photo company on Capitol Street and hang out with the real photographers.
Ah, your real education.
So I knew that if I had, they were going to move me to Callaway High School.
Right.
And I knew if I went over there, I would fail. So I talked my dad into letting me drop out of school, and I was going to finish with correspondence courses.
And?
My draft number came up. It's the height of the Vietnam War, and my draft number was number 7. So I joined the Army, and the Army Photo Corps, surprisingly, is one of the best places, was and continues to be one of the best places on Earth to receive photographic training. And so I got, I joined the Army to get in the Photo Corps, and I got to basic training, and they said, Private Dollarhide, the Photo Corps is full.
Uh-oh.
You have been reassigned to Camera Repair School. as it turned out, I had braces on. They let me out of the Army on a temporary medical discharge. They made a mistake and gave me a permanent 4F.
Goodness.
So I skipped right past the Vietnam War.
You dropped out of high school. Now you've dropped out of the Army.
And while I was in the Army, I got a GED, and I went and did a little while at Hines Junior College, where I met my very lovely ex-wife, Catherine.
That's, you know, junior colleges are good for a lot of things.
Yeah, right. I think that's probably the only thing I did of merit at Hines Junior College, where I was also the school photographer.
Of course you were.
But, you know.
So why do I have in my mind that you were down at Southern in the film school?
Maybe because every one of my employees for the last 30, 40 years.
You've come out of
all
there.
My proteges all came through Southern.
But not you.
But not me.
Huh. You were sort of self-trained and learned on the job. And
You know, I'm in 1971, Sergio Fernandez was doing a radio show on ZZQ FM.
Right.
And they brought back the old Lamar Cranston, The Shadow.
Oh, The Shadow knows.
And they wanted to make a TV spot to promote it. And so they... WAPT gave Sergio a 16mm film camera and said, well, you can shoot your own.
Wow.
Because he had been through film school.
Right, he'd gone down to Southern.
And he called me up and said, Dollarhide, I have no clue what to do. Come help me. And so we went out in the woods with a scantily clad woman.
Oh, my goodness.
And had her run through the woods. And I saw that image through the camera. And back then, only the cameraman could see the image.
Right.
There were no video monitors.
Right.
And then we went and had the film developed, and we took it up to Sergio's apartment where he had tie-dye sheets covering the windows.
Probably still does.
And we put up the film on the projector, you know, the original film that ran through the camera and turned out the lights. And when I saw that image that moving image that I had seen in the eyepiece.
Right.
I said, to hell with these still images.
Yeah.
I want moving images.
I want action.
And so that's how I became a cinematographer as opposed to a photographer.
Wow. So let's talk a little bit about Sergio. You mentioned him, just to say that Sergio Fernandez, who owns and operates Fernandez Creative Services, is a musician, plays with These Days and a bunch of other bands, good friend of yours and mine. But also, he was a DJ for years on ZZQ. Now, did you have any relationship with ZZQ other than just friends with Sergio?
I mean, I was close friends with both Sergio and the late Dave Adcock.
David Adcock.
Going back to when it was WJDX FM.
Mm-hmm.
And actually just came across a photograph that I took of Sergio in the control room upstairs at the WLBT facilities, which I took in early 1970.
Wow.
It would have been late 1970.
But you never worked as a radio.
I never worked in radio.
DJ. No, you went straight to film. And your first camera, your movie camera, as it were. What was your first piece of equipment that took you from still to movie?
I left Hines Junior College, and I knew I wanted to do filmmaking.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to do cinematography.
Right.
That's what I knew at that point. And the only place in Jackson that at that time that really offered an opportunity for me was a company called Jasper Ewing and Sons.
Yeah, on State Street.
So yeah, it was an audiovisual supply company.
Right.
And I talked Mr. Ewing into starting a production department. And the first job we got was the Jackson State football playbacks. And
wow.
Walter Payton was a senior. And the next thing I knew, I was shooting for NFL Films and ABC and NBC and NCAA. And that's how I started.
Sports photographer.
That's it.
You're listening to a special rebroadcast of a 2012 Arts Hour interview with Mississippi filmmaker Jim Dollarhide, who died in a house fire in March of 2016. Hi, I'm Malcolm White. Thanks for listening to the Mississippi Arts Hour podcast. You can also hear the show on MPB Think Radio every Sunday afternoon at 5 p.m. For access to more conversations with creative Mississippians, subscribe to the podcast using your favorite podcast app.
Hello, I'm Dr. Nancy Lottridge Anderson, president of New Perspectives, a fee-only financial advising firm and co-host of Money Talks. For over 10 years, Money Talks has been answering your personal financial questions and sharing knowledge about money management. Money Talks can be heard Tuesdays at 9 a.m. on MPB Think Radio. Podcasts can be found on our website, money.mpbonline.org, or on your smart device's podcasting platform.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
I'm Malcolm White, and today on the Mississippi Arts Hour, we're rebroadcasting my 2012 interview with my good friend, Mississippi filmmaker Jim Dollarhide, who was tragically killed in a house fire in 2016. This part of the conversation begins with Jim's memories of Mississippi author Willie Morris.
I had some great times with Willie. He told me, I think my favorite quotation in the world, he told me late one night,
mm-hmm.
and guess what goes on with Willie late at night?
Great quotes.
he said, Jim, the only thing you'll take to your grave is your memories, unless you write them down. Write them down, Jim.
This is from a guy who wrote three memoirs. Willie Morris, the late, great Willie Morris. So the music that we listened to before the soundtrack music from My Dog Skip was B.B. King and his iconic Thrill Is Gone. And, Jim, you've worked with BB for years. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that relationship, how you got connected to him, and all of the years of work that you've done, I guess, leading up to the culmination of the BB King Museum and this last film you did with him. Just talk a little bit about Jim Dolleheide and BB King.
Well, that's a thrill that's not gone. It was one of the greatest thrills of my life. And I still have some ongoing projects with the museum in Indianola. But I met BB when I was 20 years old. I believe that it was the very first Medgar Evers homecoming.
Right.
And while the homecoming was held in Fayette, Charles and BB, that'd be Charles Evers, decided because of BB's stature at the time and the fact that they wanted to attract white audiences to the homecoming to hold the concert in Jackson at the Coliseum.
Right.
BB had just a couple of years before crossed over to white audiences. This is in 1972. He was touring the world with the Rolling Stones as the opening act. And the thrill had gone, had come out in 67, I think, 68 mm-hmm. maybe. Our friend, Drake Elder,
Bebop Records,
was handling the concert for Charles, and he let my, future bride to be and a couple of our friends backstage to get an autograph. Uh-huh. And as BB walked up to us, smiling and sweating because he had just come off the stage, and as he always does, even today, he always asks his fans as he signs an autograph, "Where are you from and what do you do?" Mm-hmm. And I said, "Well, I'm from Greenwood, Mississippi, and I'm a filmmaker." Of course, at that point, I was a wannabe filmmaker.
Slight exaggeration.
And he went, "Dolleheide. Now, did your family own a music store in Greenwood?" I said, "Yes, my dad." He said, "Only place between Memphis and New Orleans I could get real guitar strings." And he said, "What are you doing tomorrow?" I looked at Catherine and I said, "I don't know." And he said, "Why don't you come up to Memphis and let's talk about filmmaking and the blues?" I guess he just took a liking to me.
Uh-huh.
I guess, you know, here's a young white kid from Mississippi. He had New York management at the time.
Right.
And I think he felt like he could trust me. So we got in our MGB and we drove to met at the pre-assigned spot at Handy Park on Beale Street. And precisely at 3 o'clock, BB pulled up in a purple Cadillac by himself, no entourage. And we sat there on a park bench, which is still there today, and talked about filmmaking. And what was on my mind was that at the time, white and black audiences, they were listening to Motown, soul music.
Right.
There weren't many people listening to the blues, uh-huh. particularly in the young black people, and that disturbed BB. So at that point, he had decided he wanted to make a film about his life and through his life tell the story of the blues. And the year before, his New York management had hired a filmmaker from New York, and who followed BB around the world. And a year had passed, and BB had never seen any footage from it.
Hmm.
So he wound up shipping me all of this film. He was breaking up with his management in New York.
Right.
And one of the issues was this film, because BB paid for it.
Right.
Handsomely, probably, you know, a couple hundred thousand dollars in 1972 dollars. So, we talked for hours, and I don't know, 2 or 3 months later, a big Shippers Express truck shows up with a a crate, a wooden crate that was about 4 feet by 4 feet by 4 feet. And I looked on it, and it said B.B. King Management. And we took it, we had to get one of these portable forklifts right. to move it into the elevator to take it upstairs. And we pried it open, and there was hundreds and hundreds of cans of 16-millimeter film. Mm. And B.B. put me to task to analyze it and report to him, which I did. And it turned out the film was shot by an amateur, another wannabe filmmaker. But this guy had no sense of the craft at all. Mm. And I thought it was worthless.
Wow.
As fate would have it, when we started the museum project, I started digging around trying to find that film. And the last thing I had seen of it is I had sent it to Bill Ferris when he was at Ole Miss at the Center for the Study of Southern Culture. We decided that would be a good place to vault it.
Right. Well, maybe he had given his music collection.
Right. This all happened about the same time.
Right.
And, you know, meanwhile, Bill had long gone to North Carolina.
Well, first, yeah, he went to D.C. and was the chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, and now
North Carolina. And, we called Bill, and he you know, claimed no knowledge of it.
Uh-huh.
The center had no knowledge of it.
Goodness.
So we thought it was lost. And one day I was in B.B.'s manager's office in New York, 10th Avenue, at just one block south of Central Park. And I looked down on a shelf, and I saw a can of film, a silver Kodak can. And I recognized the label instantly. It was from Motion Picture Laboratories in Memphis. And the handwriting was from my former assistant, the late Kendall Wilson.
Oh, my goodness.
And I picked this up, and I went, Tina, where did this come from? And she says, oh, there's a big box of film out at Sid Seidenberg's estate.
Wow.
And we retrieved the film, and we took it back to NFL Films, where I have had this longstanding right. relationship. And they restored it digitally for us. So,
wow.
long, you know, big circle there.
Yeah.
And all of that. We used a lot of that footage in the museum films.
Right.
But in 2005, the little groundswell in Indianola, they'd started out. They were thinking they were going to put it in the museum in a little storefront, maybe spend a couple of $100,000 on it.
Right.
And by this time, it was hovering around $10 million and growing. And they had engaged a design firm from Washington to design the museum. And they had received funding now. And the first thing the design firm says, we need to send a film crew down to Mississippi to document the oral histories or film the interviews mm-hmm. of B.B.'s living contemporaries. You know, people he grew up with.
Right, right.
And Alan Hammonds, from the consummate ad man from Greenwood, who I've known for 30 years or more, said, wait. We have a filmmaker in Mississippi. Instead of sending down a film crew from Washington, we have a filmmaker in Mississippi who's Oscar-nominated, and he's known B.B. for 35 years. So that got their attention, and they vetted me, and I got the job. And that started a 3.5-year journey, on off and on, of course.
Right.
We traveled around the world with B.B. We filmed his the recording of his last studio CD, which is called One Kind Favor. Went to his club in New York. Spent about a week in his home with him in Las Vegas. Just And my oldest son, earlier you referred to me as your friend Dollar. On a film crew, everybody's got a nickname.
Uh-huh.
And all my crew calls me Dollar. And when my son joined the crew, they started calling him 50 Cent.
Bet he loved that.
Well, he took it on the chin, and now he's a policeman for the Madison Police Force. And he related this story to one of his police buddies, and it got passed up the chain, and they started calling him 50 Cent at roll call.
And some rapper stole his name.
Yeah, right. And now I think that rapper's dead.
I think he passed.
Did he pass?
I think. I don't know. I'm not here to.
I know Heavy D. I know Heavy D just 50 passed.
50 Cent was a well-known hip-hop rap artist. Maybe still be. We don't know.
You know, BB only recorded one rap song in his life, and it was with Heavy D.
Hmm.
And it was called Lucille.
Ah. He sampled it? And,
it was. I wish I could remember the words off the top of it. Lucille, can I get a date? but anyway, it was extra special because my son got to travel with me, and it's just really a journey of a lifetime for me,
right,
to document his life. And the finished films in the museum are an hour long of mm-hmm. total length.
Right.
And we have enough film to do 10 one-hour shows on wow. BB's life.
And how old is BB now?
BB is 85.
85. Still playing.
Still playing.
On the road.
He's having a little trouble here and there now with, anybody gets up to 85 right, and sure. has lived a life that he has, he's got a little dementia going on, but he's still out there on the road.
Yeah.
I'm Malcolm White. You're listening to a conversation that I had in 2012 with legendary Mississippi filmmaker Jim Dollarhide, who died in a house fire in March of 2016. Hi, I'm Malcolm White. Thanks for listening to the Mississippi Arts Hour podcast. You can also hear the show on MPB Think Radio every Sunday afternoon at 5 p.m. For access to more conversations with creative Mississippians, subscribe to the podcast using your favorite podcast app.
Hi, I'm Jason Klein from Fix-It 101. If you ever thought about changing the doorknob or fixing a leaky faucet, some jobs just aren't that difficult, and yes, you can do it. If you want to find out how to do those things, listen to Fix-It 101, podcast everywhere.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
I'm Malcolm White, and you're listening to my 2012 interview with my great friend, Mississippi filmmaker Jim Dollarhide, who tragically was killed in a house fire in 2016. To start this final part of the conversation, I asked Jim about the art of photography.
I started in the darkroom,
mm-hmm.
and that is very much a craft, or it was. It's,
uh-huh.
it's a vanishing craft.
Right. Digital now.
But photographic silver-based printmaking was a certainly, you had to learn the craft.
Mm-hmm.
And, the darkroom was where I learned more about composition than actually looking through the camera.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was this tactile experience of moving that easel around and changing the composition. And, it's not like working with Photoshop in a mouse. It was different.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you touched it.
Right.
And I remember in the early 70s when I was still kind of a wannabe, my very first mentor in cinematography was a real Hollywood cameraman who lived in Jackson. His name was Jim Lucas. Hmm. And Jim was what is referred to in the Hollywood speak as a camera operator, and he had come up through the union, which back then, if you wanted to work on real movies,
right,
you had to go through the union and you had to learn the craft. And I had said something to Jim about the art of cinematography, and he looked at me and he said, "Jim, you know, before you talk about the art of cinematography, you have to learn the craft." And then he kind of wryly smiled and said, "And learning the craft takes a lifetime." And that thing that he told me is so true today in the digital world. Anyone can pick up a digital camera, be it a high-definition camcorder or a still camera, and instantly become a videographer, filmmaker, or photographer. And you don't have to learn the craft.
Because of the technology.
Because the technology has made accessing the craft so easy.
Mm-hmm.
But if you really want if you want art to come out of your craft, you have to learn the craft. It amazes me the number of people who hang out a shingle and as a film or video production company who have no clue about light and shadow, form and texture, composition, you know, basic elements.
The elements, yeah.
And that's just part of the digital age, you know. It's just there's tremendous strides have been made in technology, but along with it have, there's some flaws in how it affects the art world. And Chris Porter,
photographer,
who many listeners will know as H.C. Porter.
Right.
She and I both started in the darkroom. Turned out she picked up a paintbrush and combined that with her still camera. Mm-hmm. I picked up a still camera and then combined that with a movie camera. But we share a lot in common. And I heard her Arts Hour story. And so I know that she and I share a lot of familiar things,
mm-hmm,
about art and craft.
So talk a little bit about how you work today. It's 2012. All this technology that you just mentioned is in place, but yet you're working in the field. I mean, you still got your shingle out there. You're still working. Are you combining the old with the new, or are you just using the new technology and being artful about it?
Well, in the late 70s, video portapacks became available in the professional world.
Uh-huh.
And for the first time, you could easily take a video camera out on location and shoot video, which today we would call originating on video.
Uh-huh.
And I turned my nose up at it for the longest time. And finally, in the 80s, I had a large company at that time called
Took
ImageWorks.
You a decade.
Yeah.
To get comfortable with it.
I never got comfortable with it. No, okay. I didn't say that.
Okay.
I had a company, and I had 15 employees, and I needed to feed those employees.
Yeah.
So we embraced the video world. But I still didn't work in it.
Right.
My employees worked in it. But I stuck to – I wanted to feel and hear in my ear the vibrations of that motion picture camera turning and film going through the aperture.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until I started BB's project that I drug myself kicking and screaming into the digital world. And I quickly embraced it.
Uh-huh.
We decided immediately that because we were going to interview so many people in so many places, and the interviews would be so lengthy that it was would just be impossible to shoot it on motion picture film because of the prohibitive cost.
You're right.
At 10 minutes of motion picture film to process it and transfer it to digital medium and color correct it costs maybe $400-$500.
Uh-huh.
30 minutes of digital videotape costs $19.
Goodness.
And now it's changed to where we're originating to digital files. And you use the same cards and over, and you archive them to hard drives.
All right.
But I did. I went kicking and screaming. But I went to New York, and I went to one of the leading rental companies that I do business with. And this is in late 2004. And they set up every digital camera, or at that time what we called HD cameras,
mm-hmm.
and allowed me to test them side by side. And I picked one particular format. But what I immediately embraced about it was that you had these beautiful I have a 9-inch, a 17-inch, and a 23-inch monitor. They're LCDs, made by Panasonic, and they're it's like the Apple saying, WYSIWYG, what you see is what you get.
Mm-hmm.
So now, in motion picture days, only the cinematographer had any clue about what the image was going to look like. It was not going to look like it looked to your eye.
Right.
But now, with digital acquisition is what we call it. It typically is in high definition. You look at the monitor, and what you see is what you're getting.
Mm-hmm.
Precisely. And as a filmmaker who had my start was in photography, and the basis of my life's work was on motion picture film, being able to see exactly what I was getting freed me from having to go through the mental process of making determinations about what it's going to look like.
Ah, as you went along.
Because, I love to make documentaries, and I would do that for the rest of my life and nothing else. Particularly if they were made about Mississippi stories.
Right.
But I have to make a living.
Sure.
So I make high-end or high-quality television commercials,
mm-hmm.
To make a living. And, now, back then, the ad agency folks would sit around and they wouldn't have a clue what you were doing.
You just deliver some product and say, here it is.
Yeah, we'd go shoot it, and the first time they'd see it is when the film came back. And now they
would. Now they're your partners in editing.
Now they would not think of going on a set without having monitors for, big
right.
monitors for them to sit and look at.
Right, right.
And that's just, part of the change in technology. It's changed every facet of how we work.
And you and I just worked on a project with Mississippi Development Authority and the Mississippi Arts Commission on the creative economy. And you shot three beautiful short documentaries sort of helping us explain what on earth the creative economy is. And I must tell you, I have very much appreciated your craft and your art. When I stand before 200 people and try to explain what the creative economy is, when I have these films to back me up, it's a whole different a way of explanation. I can refer to the study, I can deliver charts, I can talk about comparisons,
do a PowerPoint,
but all I have to do is roll one of those short docs and everybody in the room knows
gets
what
it.
The creative economy
yeah.
is.
Well, you're the star of
well,
a couple
I'm
of them,
one
so
of them, but,
yeah.
But anyway, that was so that's sort of what you do for a living these days, is that type short filmmaking?
Most of my work is what you would call sponsored filmmaking.
Uh-huh. I got you.
This past year, I did several sponsored films for St. Dominic's Hospital. I did a pro bono project for Metro Jackson Habitat for Humanity.
Right.
And then I also still make commercials occasionally.
And where is the body of work? Where can the public go on the internet and see your films and see your work and explore what you do?
They can go to Facebook and just type in and search my name. Mm-hmm. They can choose to friend me or not, but all of my photographs, which are mostly snapshots of my kids and working, I have a lot of my short films on my Facebook page, and they're all open to the public.
So just type in Jim Dollarhide.
I'm the top hit, yeah.
You're there. Okay, great. Okay, one last topic I'd like to discuss is sort of where you live and what your passion is for fishing.
Well, my passion for fishing is eating it.
Tell us about that. You love the bass, do you?
I do love bass fishing, perhaps more than that. To answer your question, I live at Lake Cavalier, mm-hmm. which I finally refer to as Fabulous Lake Cavalier.
And you've been there for a while.
I've been there since 1993 through 97. I was part-time, and I've been there full-time since 97.
Okay, living on the lake.
And from 97 till around 2005, I was lucky enough to have the penthouse in the Lamar Life building, mm-hmm. The little room under the clock tower,
right,
where Eudora Welty worked as a copywriter for WJDX-AM when they became Mississippi's first radio station.
Wow.
Very historic. But I live at Lake Cavalier. In 2005, I built a larger home, and my office and my editing studio are in my home, and that's where I'll spend the rest of my days.
I'm Malcolm White. Thanks for listening to my 2012 interview with legendary Mississippi filmmaker Jim Dollarhide, who we lost in a house fire in the March of 2016. Hi, I'm Malcolm White. Thanks for listening to the Mississippi Arts Hour podcast. You can also hear the show on MPB Think Radio every Sunday afternoon at 5 p.m. For access to more conversations with creative Mississippians, subscribe to the podcast using your favorite podcast app.
Deep South Dining is the show all about the culture of Southern flavor. From fried chicken and collard greens to shrimp and grits and a glass of sweet tea. Subscribe now to the podcast using any podcast app or download our MPB public media app.